The red suits you.
I tried my best to make light of it. Why, Komazar, are you actually trying to be kind?
I can be kind, Leah, if you'll let me be.
He took a step closer, his eyes molten. Shall I call the dressmakers back in? I asked.
Not yet, he said, strolling closer.
It's not easy to move in a dress held together with pins.
I don't want you to move.
He stopped in front of me and ran a gentle finger down my sleeve. His chest rose in a deep, controlled breath.
You've come a long way since the burlap dress you wore on your arrival.
That wasn't a dress. It was a sack. He smiled.
So it was.
He reached up and pulled a pin from the dress. The fabric at the shoulder fell loose.
Is that better?
I bristled. Save your charming seductions for our wedding night.
I was being charming? Shall I take out another pin?
I took a step back, which I was loath to do, for fear it would encourage him. I tried to change the subject and noticed he had changed into riding clothes. Isn't there something you should be doing right now? Somewhere you need to be?
No.
He stepped forward, reaching for another pin, but I hit his hand away. Are you trying to seduce me or force yourself on me? Since we've agreed to be honest with each other, I'd like to know up front so I can decide how to proceed. He grabbed my arms, and I winced at the prick of pins in my flesh. He pulled me close and pressed his lips to my ear.
Why do you shower the assassin with your affections and not your betrothed?
Because Caden has not demanded my affections. He has earned them.
Have I not been kind to you, Jezalia?
You were kind once, I whispered against his cheek. I know you were. And you had a name. Reginaeus. He pulled away as if I'd thrown cold water on him. A real name, I continued, feeling a rare advantage. A name given to you by your mother. He stepped toward the hearth. His ardor vanished.
I have no mother, he snapped.
It was evident I had opened one of the few veins of warm blood in his body. It would be easy enough for me to believe that was true, I said. It seems more likely that you were spawned by a demon and an available knothole. Except that I spoke to the woman who held you as your mother grunted you onto this earth. She said your mother named you with her last breath.
There's nothing special about that, princess. I'm not the first Venden whose mother died in childbirth.
But it's a name. Something she gave to you. Why do you refuse to be called by the last word that left your mother's lips?
Because it was a name that meant nothing, he lashed out. It gave me nothing. I was only another filthy brat on the streets. I was nothing until I became the assassin. That name meant something. There was only one name better. Komazar. Why settle for Reginaeus, as common as dirt and just as useful, when there's a name that only one can bear?
Is that why you killed the last Komazar? Only for a name? Or to avenge Calantha's cruel beating? His fury waned, and he peered at me cautiously.
She told you?
Yes. He shook his head.
That's not like Calantha. She never speaks of that day.
He threw another log onto the fire and stared into the flames.
I was only 18. Too young to become the next Komazar. I hadn't built enough alliances yet. But I hungered for it. Every day, I imagined. Komazar.
He turned and sat down on the raised hearth.
And then Calantha happened. Most of the council was quite fond of her. She was a pretty little flower then, but they didn't dare go near her for fear of the Komazar. She was ruined by the beating, scarred inside and out. But many of the council favored me after that for saving her life. When Calantha pledged her loyalty to me, many of the council did too. The ones who didn't, I eliminated. I had learned then that alliances are not just offered. They have to be carefully devised.
He stood and walked closer to me.
To answer your question, one purpose simply served another. Avenging her beating also brought me a name that I desired.
He gave the dress a cold perusal.
Tell the dressmakers that one will do, he said, offering his final approval. And, princess, just so you know, if you bring up the name Regineus again, I'll have to pay a visit to the midwife with the loose tongue. Do you understand?
I dipped my head in a single nod.
I know of no one by that name.
He smiled and left.
And I spoke the truth. It was clear that the boy named Regineus was long dead.
Chapter 51.
I'll be moving you to a room near my quarters tomorrow. Servants will come to gather your things. This will make it more convenient once the wedding is behind us.
Convenient. My skin prickled. I knew what convenient meant. It was strange that I should find comfort in Caden's quarters, but I did. I knew Caden was at least trustworthy in certain things, even when he was stinking drunk. His quarters also had a secret passage. I doubted my new chamber would. We left our horses with the guards on the outer edge of a thicket of trees, and the Komazar guided me through the woods. The trees were thin-trunked and close together, but I could see where a path had been worn through them. This was an oft-visited destination. He called it his own personal shortcut. After only a few minutes of walking, the line of trees stopped, and we emerged on a bluff that overlooked a vast valley. I stared, not quite sure of what I was seeing.
It's magnificent, isn't it?
I looked at him, his face glowing. This was where his passion lay. His gaze floated over the valley. It was a city, but nothing like the one we had just left. It was a city of soldiers. Thousands. He didn't notice that I hadn't answered him or even spoken, but he began systematically pointing out the regions of his city in list-like fashion. There were the breeding grounds, the smelteries, the forges, the armories, the barracks, the Fletcher shops, the cooperages, the greeneries, the testing fields. He went on and on. Everything was plural. The city stretched to the horizon. I didn't need to ask what it was for. Armies served only two purposes, to defend or attack. They weren't here to defend anything. Nobody wanted into Venda. I tried to see just what was going on at the testing grounds, but it was too far away. I squinted and sighed. All I see from here is a sprawling city. Can we get a closer look? He happily led me down a twisting trail to the valley floor. I heard the riotous ping of iron being hammered on anvils. Many anvils. The hum of the city surrounded me, a hum of single-mindedness and purpose. He walked me among the soldiers, and I saw their faces, boy and girl alike, many as young as Eben. He walked briskly so I couldn't stop to talk to any of them, but he made sure they knew who and what I was, a sign that the gods favored Venda. Their young faces turned in curiosity as we passed. "There are so many," I said stupidly, more to myself than the Komazar. The immensity of it was staggering. The patrols were being slaughtered. They were hiding something. something important. This, an army twice as large as any one kingdom's. He brought me to a level knoll that looked out over another stretch of valley. Trenches and ramparts surrounded it. I watched soldiers wheel large devices to the middle of the field, but the contraptions gave no hint of their purpose until they began using them. Arrows flew at dizzying rates, a blur in the air as a soldier turned a crank. A wall of arrows were all being shot by one man. It was like nothing I had ever seen. After that came another testing field, and another. These weapons had a sophistication that didn't match the spare, crude life of the Vendans. He pulled me along in his zeal, and it was the last field that froze me with terror. "What are they?" I asked. I stared at golden-striped horses twice the girth of other horses, and at least 20 hands high, their black eyes wild and their nostrils breathing fierce steam into the cool air.
"Brezolots," he answered. "They have nasty dispositions and aren't good for riding, but they run straight and true when prodded. Their hide is thick. Nothing will stop them. Almost nothing."
He hailed a soldier for a demonstration. The soldier strapped a small pack to the horse's back and then struck his hindquarters with a sharp prod. Blood spurted from his rump, but the horse ran straight and true, just as the Komazar said he would, and even though soldiers along the side of the field pelted him with arrows, they didn't penetrate his thick hide, and he didn't stop. He headed straight across the field, directly between hillocks of hay, and then there was a deafening noise and a blinding fireball. Burning hay rained down. Splinters of wood, along with pieces of the horse, thudded to the ground. It was like a pot of oil had exploded in a fire, but with 1,000 times more power. I blinked, too shocked to move.
"They're unstoppable. One horse can take down a whole squad of men. It's amazing what the right combination of ingredients can do. We call them our death steeds."
Ice crept down my spine. "How did you learn the right combination of ingredients?" I asked.
"It was right beneath our noses all along."
He didn't need to say more. The purveyors of knowledge. That was why they skulked in the caverns and catacombs. They were unlocking the secrets of the ancients and giving the Komazar the recipe for Morrigan's destruction. What had he promised them in return for their services? Their own piece of Morrigan? Whatever the price, great or small, it could never be worth the lives that would be lost. We moved on to more fields, but now I hardly saw them, trying to imagine how any army could stand up to what I'd already seen. Finally, we stood at the base of 5 towering granaries, with walls of polished steel that were blinding in the sun. These were enormous stores of food on the edge of a city in want. "Why?" I asked.
"Great armies march on their stomachs. Men and horses must be fed. There's almost enough here to march 100,000 soldiers."
"March where?" I asked, hoping that by some grace of the gods I could be wrong.
"Where do you think, princess?" he asked. "Soon Vendans will no longer be at the mercy of Morrigan.
Half of these soldiers are children.
Young, but not children. Only the Morrigese have the luxury of pampering fresh-cheeked babies. Here they're muscle and sweat like everyone else, doing their part to help feed a future for us all."
"But the loss. You'll still lose people," I said. "Especially the young ones."
"Probably half of them. But the one thing Venda doesn't lack is people. When they die, they'll be glad for the cause, and there are always more to replace them."
I stood there, stunned, taking in the enormity of his plans. I had guessed they were planning something, an attack on an outpost, something, but not this. I searched for something to say, but I knew my plea was futile before it ever left my tongue. Still, the words spilled out, weak and already vanquished. I might be able to plead with my father and the other kingdoms. I've seen how Venda struggles. I could convince them. There's fertile land in the Camlanteau. I know I could find a way to make them let you settle it. There's good land to farm. Enough for all of you to...
You? Plead with anyone? You're a hated enemy of two kingdoms now. And even if you could convince them, I have far greater aspirations than to be dragged by a yoke and harness. What is a Komazar without a kingdom to rule? Or many kingdoms? No, you'll plead for nothing.
I grabbed his arms, forcing him to look at me. It doesn't have to be this way between the kingdoms. A faint smile lit his face.
Yes, my princess, it does. It is how it's always been and always will be. Only now it will be us wielding power over them.
He pulled away from my grip, and his gaze returned to his city, his chest puffing, his stature growing before my eyes.
It's my turn now to sit on a golden throne in Morrigan and dine on sweet grapes in winter. And if any royals survive our conquest, it will give me great pleasure to lock them up on this side of hell to fight over roaches and rats to fill their bellies.
I stared at the consuming power glistening in his eyes. It pumped through his veins instead of blood, and beat in his chest instead of a heart. My plea for compromise was babble to his ears, a language long erased from his memory.
Well?
He asked. A terrible greatness rolled across the land. A new terrible greatness. I said the only thing I could say. What I knew he wanted to hear. You've thought of everything, Cher Komazar. I'm impressed. And in a dark and frightening way, I was.
Chapter 52 Rafe.
I hovered near the fire pit in Hawk's pavilion, pretending to warm my hands. Ulrichs had given me changes of clothing, but they hadn't included any gloves. It was just as well. It gave me an excuse to stand here with Sven, who had also forgotten to wear his gloves to the pavilion. We watched the keeper training the hawks. Orin stood opposite us as a lookout for anyone who might approach. "He has 8 barrels in a cave down by the river," Sven whispered, even though the nearest guards stood far behind us on the other side of the court. "He says he only needs 4 more." "How is he getting them?" "You don't want to know. Let's just say Venden justice would leave him fingerless. His thievery better be flawless, because he's going to need every finger to secure that raft. He did acquire the rope, honestly, thanks to the princess and the money she gave him. The kind of rope he needed can only be had in the Jahendra, which would be far more difficult to lift things from, so thank the gods she's good at cards." I thought about the card game and the blood I had sweat watching her play. Yes, thank the gods and her brothers, she is good. "Jeb used paddies to cover the rope up in the bottom of his cart and sneak it out to Tavish." Sven held his hands closer to the flames and asked me about the sanctum routines. I told him more of what I had learned in these past weeks, what times the guards changed at the entrances, how many could be found in hallways at any given moment, when Leah was most likely not to be missed, the governors who were more amiable than others, those who tipped their mugs heavily, the Ratan and Chevdars he didn't dare turn his back on, and where I had hidden weapons, 3 swords, 4 daggers, and a poleaxe.
You pilfered weapons right under their noses? A poleaxe?
It just takes patience.
You? Patience? Sven grunted.
I couldn't blame him for his cynicism. I was the one who rode off with only a half-assed plan to guide us. I thought about the last several days, and all the times I'd had to restrain my natural impulses. The agonizing waiting when all I wanted to do was act, weighing the satisfaction of a victorious moment against a lifetime with Leah, calculating every move and word to make sure it gave her and us the best possible chance. If there was a torture in hell crafted specifically for me, this was it. Yes, patience, I said. It was a scar as painfully won as any in battle. I told him that Calantha and Ulrix were my primary guards, and that Calantha missed nothing. So I had little opportunity around her, but after laying me flat several times and finding that I offered only a weak fight, Ulrix had grown satisfied that the emissary was not one to waste much worry over. Opportunities arose, and slowly I slipped one mislaid weapon after another into dark, forgotten corners, to be retrieved and moved to another dark corner until I had them where I was sure no one would find them.
No one missed them? Not even the poleaxe?
There are always a few swords set aside during late nights and card games in the sanctum. When losers get nervous, they drink, and when they drink, they forget things. In the morning, servants return mislaid weapons to the armory. The poleaxe was luck. I saw it propped up against the sow pen for the better part of a day. When no one seemed to miss it, I tossed it behind the woodpile. Sven nodded with approval, as if I were still his charge in training.
What about last night? Have you gotten any whiff of suspicions about the sword fight?
I fumbled. I lost. My shoulder drew first blood. By now, that's all they remember. Any skill with the sword is lost in the shadow of Caden's victory. We saw Orin on the other side of the fire, signaling us that someone was approaching, and we stopped talking.
"Morning, Governor O'Bron. Feeding mice to the falcons?"
We turned. It was Grizz. He spoke in Morrigese, which he had claimed he didn't know. I looked at Sven, but he wasn't responding. Instead, the old Kurd had paled. Orin and I both knew something was wrong. Orin began to draw his sword, but I waved him back. Grizz wore 2 short swords, and his hands gripped the hilts of both. He stood too close to Sven for us to make a move. Grizz grinned, soaking in Sven's reaction.
"After 25 years and that trophy crossing your face, I didn't recognize you right off. It was your voice that gave you away."
"Falgris," Sven said at last, as if he were looking at a ghost.
"Looks like you've gained an ugly trophy up top, too, and a sizable gut down below. Flattery won't get you out of this." "It did the last time."
A smile creased the giant's eyes in spite of the scowl that crossed his scarred brow.
"He's the one who lied to the Commissar for me," I said.
Grizz whipped his gaze at me.
"I didn't lie for you, Twinkle Toes. Let's get that straight right now. I lied for her."
"You're a spy for her kingdom?" I asked.
His lips curled back in disgust.
"I'm a spy for you, you blasted fool!"
Sven's eyebrows shot up. This was obviously a new development for him, too.
Grizz jerked his head towards Sven. "All those years stuck with this lout gave me a little knowledge about courts, and a lot of knowledge about languages. I'm no traitor to my own kind, if that's what you're thinking, but I meet with your scouts. I carry useless information from one enemy kingdom to another. If royals want to throw their money away for the tracking of troops, I'm happy to oblige. It keeps my kinfolk from starving.
I looked at Sven.
This is who you were stuck with in the mines?
For 2 very long years. Grizz saved my life, he answered.
Get it right, Grizz snarled. You saved my neck, and we both know it.
Orin and I exchanged a glance. Neither one seemed pleased about his spared life or in agreement over who saved whom. Sven rubbed his stubble, studying Grizz.
So, Falgrizz, do we have a problem?
You're still a dense bastard, Grizz answered. Yes, we have a problem. I don't want her leaving, and I assume that's what you're here for.
Sven sighed.
Well, you're partially right, he nodded toward me. I'm here to spring this knucklehead, and that's all. You can keep the girl.
What? I said.
Sorry, boy, King's orders. We've got an escort waiting just on the other side of the river. I lunged at Sven, grabbing him by his vest. You lying, filthy—
Grizz yanked me off Sven and threw me to the ground.
Don't be messing with our new governor, emissary.
Sanctum guards began running over after seeing me jump Sven.
Not much of a guard, are you?
Grizz said to Orin, who hadn't moved to protect Sven.
At least look like you know what you're doing, or you won't last long around here.
Orin drew his sword and held it menacingly above me. Grizz cast another warning scowl at me.
Just so we all understand each other, I don't care if you all drown in the river or beat each other senseless, but the girl stays here.
And then, just to Sven, the stitchery's an improvement.
As is the needlework on your skull.
Sven and I eyed each other. We had a problem. Grizz stomped off, telling the approaching guards to go back to their posts. The matter was settled, but as I watched him walk away, I noticed the assassin standing in the shadow of the colonnade. He stood there, with no apparent destination, just watching us. And even after Grizz had long passed, he continued to look in our direction.
Chapter 53.
It happened when I took my boots off, the heavy clunk of the heels hitting the floor. The shoes. The whisper. The memory. The knowing chill that had settled across my shoulders the first time I heard their footsteps. Reverence and restraint. It hit me suddenly and violently, and I thought I was going to be sick. I leaned over the chamber pot, a damp sweat springing to my brow. They had changed everything but their shoes. I swallowed the salty, sick taste on my tongue and fanned my anger instead. It flamed to a rage and propelled me forward. I bypassed the guards and used the hidden passage. Where I was going, I could not have an escort. This time, when I strode through the catacombs, and then down into the cavern where piles of books waited to be burned, I gave no care to the loudness of my footsteps. When I got there, no one was in the outer room sorting books, but the far room was dimly lit. I saw at least one robed figure within, hunched over a table. The inner room was almost as large as the first, with several piles of its own waiting to be hauled away and burned. There were 8 robed figures within. I stood at the entrance watching them, but they were so consumed with their tasks they didn't notice me. Their hoods were drawn, as was their practice, supposedly a symbol of humility and devotion, but I knew the purpose was as much to block out others so they could remain focused on their difficult work. Their deathly work. The priest I had met with back in Taravan had sensed something was amiss, even if he hadn't known exactly what it was. I wouldn't speak to the other priests of this matter. They might not all agree where loyalties lie. I realized now that he had tried to warn me. But if the Komazar had coaxed these men here with promises of riches, I might be able to sway their greedy hearts with greater treasures. I looked down at their shoes, almost hidden by their brown robes. They seemed out of place here instead of tucked behind polished desks. I had grabbed a large volume from one of the piles of discards as I walked in, and now I threw it to the ground. The loud smack echoed through the room, and both the seated and standing scholars turned to see me. They showed no alarm, not even surprise, but the seated scholars left their chairs to stand with the others. I stopped in front of them, their faces still hidden in the shadows of their hoods. I would expect at least a cursory bow from subjects of Morrigan when their princess addresses them. The tallest one in the middle spoke for them all. I was wondering how long it would take you to find us down here. How well I remember your wanderings in Civica. His voice was vaguely familiar. Show your traitorous faces, I ordered. As your lone sovereign in this wretched kingdom, I command it. The tall one stepped forward. You haven't changed a bit, have you? But you most certainly have. Your new attire is decidedly plainer. He sighed. Yes, I do miss our embroidered silk robes, but we had to leave those behind. These are much more practical here. He pushed back his hood, and my stomach turned with nausea. He was my 10th-year tutor, Argyris. One by one, the others pushed back their hoods, too. These weren't just any scholars from remote regions. These were the elite inner circle, trained by the royal scholar himself. The royal scholar's second assistant, the lead illuminator, my 5th and 8th-year tutors, the library archivist, 2 of my brother's tutors, all scholars who had left their positions presumably for other work in sacristas throughout Morrigan. Now I knew where they had really gone, and maybe worse. I had known early on that they weren't trustworthy. Back in Civica, I had felt agitation in their presence. These were the scholars I had always hated, the ones who filled me with dread, the ones who wrestled the holy text into our heads with all the grace of a bull, and with none of the tenderness or sincerity I heard in Pauline's voice as she sang remembrances. These before me shredded the text into torn pieces of history. What did the Komazar promise to make it worth turning your back on your countrymen? Argyris smiled with the same arrogance I remembered from the days when he looked over my shoulder, berating me on the spacing of my script. We're not exactly traitors, Arabella. We're simply on loan to the Komazar, by order of the Kingdom of Morrigan. Liar, I sneered. My father would never send this kingdom anything, much less court scholars, to— I looked at the piles of books around us. What new menace are you working on now? We're merely scholars, Princess, doing what we do, Argyris answered. He and the other scholars exchanged smug grins. What others do with our findings is not our business. We simply uncover the worlds these books hold. Not all the worlds. You burn pile after pile in the sanctum ovens. He shrugged. Some texts are not as useful as others. We can't translate them all. The way he couched his words and distanced the scholars from their treachery made me ache to rip his tongue out. But I restrained myself. I still needed answers. It wasn't my father who loaned you to Venda. Who did? I demanded. They only looked at me as if I were still their impetuous charge, and smirked. I pushed past them, shoving them out of the way, ignoring their indignant huffs, and went to the table where they'd been working. I shuffled through books and papers, trying to find some evidence of who had sent them. I opened one of the ledgers, and a roughly garbed arm reached past me and snapped the tablet shut.
"I think not, Your Highness," he said, his breath hot on my ear.
He pressed so close, I could barely spin to see who it was. He pinned me against the table and smiled, waiting for recognition to wash over my face. It did. I couldn't breathe. He reached up and touched my neck, rubbing the small white mark where the bounty hunter had cut me.
"Only a nick?" He frowned. "I knew I should have sent someone else. Your sensitive royal nose probably smelled him coming a mile away."
It was the driver from the stable yard. And now I was certain, the tavern guest Pauline had mentioned to me. "You didn't see him? He walked right in after the other two, a thin, scruffy fellow. He shot plenty of sideways looks your way." And also the scruffy young man I had seen one night with the Chancellor.
"Garvin, at your service," he said, with a mock-genteel nod. "It's lovely to watch the wheels spin in your head."
There was nothing about him that would stand out. Medium build, ashy, uncombed hair. He could blend in with any crowd. It wasn't his appearance that had left an impression on me. It was the startled expression of the Chancellor when I stumbled upon him and two scholars in a dark nook of the eastern portico. Guilt had flooded their faces, but I hadn't registered it then. It was the middle of the night, and I had just snuck in from a card game and was so concerned about my own detection that I hadn't questioned their odd behavior. I glared at him. It must have been such a disappointment for the Chancellor to learn I wasn't dead. He smiled.
"I haven't seen him in months. As far as I know, he thinks you are dead. Our hunter has never failed us before, and the Chancellor had gotten word that the assassin was on your trail, too. There was little doubt that one of them would finish you. Wait until he finds out the truth."
He chuckled.
"But the spin of your greater betrayal to Morrigan in marrying the Komisar may serve his purposes even better. Well done, Your Highness."
His purposes? I thought of all the jeweled baubles that graced the Chancellor's knuckles. Gifts, he had called them. What else was he getting in return for delivering wagons of wine and the services of scholars to the Komisar? A few sparkling ornaments for his fingers could hardly be worth the cost of treason. Was it a ploy for more power? What else had the Komisar promised him? I would tell the Chancellor not to spend his riches before they're in his greedy palm. I'll remind you, I am not dead yet. Garvin laughed, and his face loomed closer to mine.
"Here?" he whispered. "Yes. Here you're as good as dead. You'll never be leaving again. At least not alive."
I tried to push past him, but he tightened his grip on the table. He was not a large man, but he was wiry and tough. I heard the snickers of the scholars, but I could see only the stubble on Garvin's chin and feel his thighs pressing close to mine. "I'll also remind you, though I may be a prisoner of the Komisar, I'm his betrothed as well, and unless you'd like to see your thin, sour hide served on a platter, I would suggest you move your arms now." His smile disappeared, and he stepped aside.
"Be on your way, and I'd advise you not to come this way again. These catacombs have many forgotten and dangerous passages. One could easily get lost forever."
I brushed past him and the scholars, tasting the bitterness of their betrayal. But when I was a few yards away, I stopped and slowly scrutinized them.
"What are you doing?"
Argyris asked. "Memorizing each of your faces, and how you look in this moment, and imagining what you'll look like a year from now as you face death. Because, as you all well know, I do have the gift, and I've seen every one of you dead. I turned and left, and heard not a shuffle nor a whisper in my wake. It was the second time in less than an hour I had perpetrated a sham. Maybe. Because in a brief, cold second, I saw every one of them hanging from a rope.
Chapter 54.
I sat on a wooden bench near the servants' stables, staring at a feather stirring on the ground, my feet and fingers numb, my thoughts jumping from rage to disbelief. Secrets at home, secrets in the caverns. Deceit knew no boundaries. Secrets. That was what I saw in Argyrus's startled eyes and felt pressing on my chest when I passed through the cavern. A dangerous secret. Movement in the distance caught my eye. He walked toward me. The ultimate betrayer. He stopped several feet away, noting that something was off. "Where are your escorts?" I didn't answer. "I've looked everywhere for you," he said. "What are you doing out here? It's freezing." So it was. "Can we talk?" he asked. I studied Caden, his eyes warm and searching. Caden wanting a truce. Make everything better. Like we were walking in a meadow after one of his drunken tirades. Caden bringing me a basket of crabapple dumplings. Caden holding me as I watched my brother die, saying how sorry he was. Caden with his steady eyes, his deceptive calm, his devastating betrayal. He stared at my jiggling knee. It wasn't I who had betrayed him. "Leah," he said, as if testing the waters. "Leah, is it safe to approach you?" "You knew," I said. My knee bounced. My hands trembled. "All along you knew." He took a cautious step forward. "What are you—" I flew at him, slapping at him, beating at him as he retreated, step after step, trying to dodge my blows. "Don't pretend you didn't know. All along you played games, telling me you were trying to save my life while you planned to exterminate every last person I love. Walther and Greta weren't enough? Now it's my other brothers? Bertie? Pauline? Gwyneth?" I stopped advancing on him and glared. "You want to kill every last person in Morrigan!" His shoulders pulled back. "You saw the army." I returned his passionless stare. "I saw the army." He was quiet for only a moment, and then he lashed out, his hand sweeping the air as if that could dismiss my accusation. "What of it? Morrigan and Dalbrecht have their armies, too. Ours isn't going to kill everyone, only those who suppress us." I looked at him in disbelief. Did he really believe that? "And I'm sure that includes your father, a high-born lord. He's probably first on your list." He didn't answer, but his jaw clenched. "So that's what it's been about all along. Vengeance. You're so consumed with hatred for your father that you want to kill every last breathing person in Morrigan." "We're marching on Morrigan, Leah. We're removing those in power, and that includes my father, and yes, he may die." "May? I don't know what will happen. I don't know what kind of fight we'll face. With our numbers, they would be wise to lay down their arms. But if not, yes, he and many others will die." "By your hand. You're a fine one to talk about vengeance. Ever since Walther's and Greta's deaths, you've chased after revenge, telling me no matter what you did, it would never be enough. Your eyes glow with vengeance every time they fall on Malak. But I don't plan on killing a whole kingdom to get it.
It's not going to happen that way. The Komazar and I have agreed that you have an agreement with the Komazar. I laughed. How wonderful for you. Yes, we all have our agreements with him. The Chancellor, the Emissary, me. He seems very good at striking agreements. You once ridiculed me for not knowing my own borders. I was shamed by that truth, but my ignorance pales in comparison with yours. I'm sure Bertie, Gwyneth, and Pauline would be so relieved to know that you have an agreement. I spun and walked away. Leah, he called after me. I promise you, I won't let any harm come to Bertie, Pauline, and Gwyneth. I paused. Without turning around, I accepted his promise with a single nod, then continued on my way. And though I wasn't sure he could make any such claim, I held on to that small bit of hope. Even if Rafe and I didn't make it, maybe Caden would remember his promise to me. On my way back to my room, I made a side trip to the caverns. There. Sometimes it takes a while to understand the truth whispering at your back. It felt like old times, slipping into the royal scholar's study. Only this time when I took something, I didn't leave a note.
And so Morrigan led the remnant across the wilderness, listening to the gods for the path of safety. And when at last they came to a place where heavy fruit the size of fists hung from trees, Morrigan dropped to her knees, shedding tears, giving thanks and uttering remembrances for all who were lost along the way, and Aldred fell down beside her, thanking the gods for Morrigan. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 5. Chapter 55.
Once again, I was alone and freezing. The fire in the gallery long turned to cold ash. I heard them calling outside. Jezalia! A story, Jezalia! The room grew pink with dusk. He had laid it all out quite clearly. It's time now. You will say my words. See these things. Do these things. I would be his pawn. His army city swam in my vision, and then Civica, destroyed, in ashes, the ruins of the citadel rising like broken fangs on the horizon, plumes of smoke clouding the sky, my own mother a puddle in the midst of rubble, weeping, alone, and tearing her hair from her scalp. I blinked again and again, trying to make the images vanish. She's coming. The words nestled full and warm beneath my ribs. I heard Astor's footsteps. They had a weight, I knew, a sound that danced with need and hope, a sound as ancient as the ruins around me. She's coming. They are coming. But now there were more footsteps, urgent, too many. My chest tightened, and I sat down on the hearth, looking at the floor, trying to discern where the sounds were coming from. The hall? The outside walkways? It seemed as if they surrounded me.
Mies? What are you doing in here? What happened to the fire? You'll catch your death in here without your cloak.
I looked up. And the gallery was full. Astor stood just a few feet away, but behind her 100, 1,000 milled, a city of another kind spread out. The gallery had no walls, no end, a never-ending horizon, thousands drawing close, watching, waiting, generations, and standing among them, only an arm's length behind Astor, was Venda.
They're waiting for you, miss. Outside. Don't you hear them?
My hair lifted from my shoulders. Wind breezed through the gallery, swirling, tickling at my neck.
Ciara. Jezalia.
Their voices rose, cutting through the wind, the lamentations of mothers, sisters, and daughters of generations past, the same voices I heard in the valley when I buried my brother, remembrances that rent distant heaven and bleeding earth, prayers not woven of sounds alone, but of stars and dust and evermore. Yes, I hear them. Aster, I whispered, turn around and tell me what you see. She did as I asked, then shook her head.
I see a mighty big floor in need of a stiff broom.
She stooped and picked up a scrap of red cloth left behind by the dressmakers.
And this here remnant.
She brought the scrap to me, placing the ragged threads in my hands. And then the gallery was a gallery again. The walls solid. The thousands gone. I held the fabric in my fist. Always belong to the world. What is magic but what we don't yet understand?
You all right, miss?
I stood. Aster, would you fetch my cloak for me? The gallery terrace will give me a better view of the square.
Not that wall, miss.
Why not?
That's the wall they say.
Her voice dropped to a whisper.
They say that's the one the Lady Venda fell from.
She looked around as if expecting to see her spirit lurking. This revelation made me hesitate, and I pushed open the door to the terrace. The hinges squealed with their own warning. The wall beyond was thick and low, just like any other in the sanctum. I won't fall, Aster. I promise. The beads on Aster's scarf jingled as she nodded, and then she raced out the door. I wrapped my cloak snug about me as I settled on the wall. The gallery terrace was wide and jutted out over the square. I said my remembrances first. Lest we repeat history, the stories shall be passed from father to son, from mother to daughter, and to all my brothers and sisters of Venda. For with but one generation, history and truth are lost forever. Hear the stories of the faithful, the whispers of the universe, the truths that ride the wind. I sang of braveries and sorrows and hope, seeing without eyes, hearing without ears, the ways of trust and a language of knowing buried deep within them, a way as old as the universe itself. I told them of the things that last, the things that remain, and of a dragon that was waking. For we must not just be ready for the enemy without, but also for the enemy within. And so shall it be, sisters of my heart, brothers of my soul, family of my flesh, forevermore. A low evermore from the crowd rose up to meet me, and they began to disperse to the warmth of their homes. And may the gods keep the wicked far from you, I whispered to myself. I had gathered my cloak to get down from the wall, when suddenly the breeze calmed. The world grew strangely silent, muffled, and white flakes began to fall from the sky. It dusted the parapets, the streets, and my lap with a sparkle of white as it floated down in lazy circles. Magical. Snow. It was a soft, cool feather brushing my cheek, exactly as Aunt Burnett had described. As the gentle flakes fell into my outstretched palm, a heavy ache grew in my chest for home. Winter was here. It felt like a door was closing.
Chapter 56. Caden.
I walked with the Komazar along the wall walk of Jagmoor Tower. Malik, Grizz, and two brethren, Jorik and Theron, trailed behind us. Now that the whole council was present, our first official session would convene tomorrow, but the unofficial sessions had already begun. The Komazar had gathered the Ratan together privately to make sure that tomorrow we sat next to the governors who were likely to balk. The Ratan was his inner circle, the 10 who never failed in our duty or wavered in our loyalty to one another and Venda. It wasn't just duty, it was a way of life we all embraced, a belonging that never had to be doubted. Our footsteps, our thoughts, everything about us presented a unified force that made even the Tjevdars measure their words. Still, the vast army was taking its toll on the provinces. One more winter, the Komazar said, just one more to secure the plans, the supplies, and the weapons that the armories were fashioning and stockpiling. The Komazar and Tjevdars had calculated exactly what was needed. Losing two governors in one season spoke of discontent, though, and several of the other governors mumbled among themselves. The Ratan was to split them up, calm their fears, remind them of the rewards to come, and if that didn't sway them, remind them of the consequences. But the deciding game piece was Leah. She was a fresh strategy, one that caught their attention, an inroad to encourage the same populace the governors had to squeeze blood from to give just a little more. If the clans were soothed, so also were the governors, and they saw the targets on their own backs shrinking. The Komazar was bringing me back into the fold, and second chances were not his way. My mad attack on him was already diminished by my easy victory over the emissary, proof that I was Ratan to the marrow, and I followed his orders by reflex. No one mentioned my verbal attack on Leah, but I knew that was as much responsible as anything for the dismissal of my transgression, not just by the Komazar, but by my brethren as well. When troubles arose, the assassin ultimately knew where his loyalties lay. The sound of our combined footsteps on the stone walk was a comforting rumble, purposeful and strong, and lately I'd had precious little comfort. As we approached Sanctum Tower, the Komazar spotted Leah sitting on the gallery wall. He grinned.
"There's my Ciara now, just as I ordered. And look how the crowds in the square have grown."
I had already noted the size.
"The numbers are twice those of yesterday," Malik said warily. "The air is bitter, and yet they still come," Grizz added.
The Komazar's face set with satisfaction.
"No doubt, due to this evening's vision."
"A vision?" I asked.
"You think I'd let her spew her nonsense forever? Remembering long-dead people and forgotten storms? Not when we have our own magnificent storm brewing. Tonight, she tells them of a vision of a battlefield where Venda is victorious. She tells them of a lifetime of spring and plenty to be gifted to the brave Vendans by the gods, making all their sacrifices worth it. That should ease the governor's and the clan's concerns."
He lifted his hand to the crowds and called out to them, as if to take credit for this turn of fortune, but none turned his way.
"They're too far away to hear you," Jorik said, "and a murmur grows among them."
The Komazar's expression darkened, and his eyes scanned the mass of people, for the first time seeming to assess the vast numbers.
"Yes," he said.
His eyes narrowed.
"That must be it."
Jorik tried to soothe Komazar's ego further by adding that he couldn't hear Leah's words either, because of the distance. But I could hear her